I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Peggy Shannon. Peggy is the founder of Queen City Cookies, and Peggy, you've got a very fascinating story. Let's talk about how you came up with the idea of Queen City Cookies and why you founded that company.
I think love of our great community and seeing what you can do and making a difference when you're committed to making a difference. In 2008, you probably remember there was the big swimming pool going on. Were we going to be able to fund them? And then the same story in 2009. And I heard one too many news broadcasts about how the budget cuts were going to potentially close the swimming pools. They ended up not doing it, thank heavens. But I decided right then that I was tired of that being part of the conversation of our lives, and that while nobody needs another company who produces cookies or any baked goods, there certainly is a need in society for a company that is committed to making a difference. So,
you know, I love this saying about living to give, just live to give. And the fact that you basically have used your business is an opportunity to have a purpose surrounding that. So purpose-driven organization, I love that.
We've been very successful, and we've, I think, made a difference in such a short amount of time. We're just 2 years old, and first year out, we started the Queen City Cookies Art Camp, which is a fabulous opportunity for kids in the Northside neighborhood, but we've expanded. I think we started with 25 kids. We're up to about 150 kids now a week, and we have free art activities in the park. Happen Inc., if you don't know Happen Inc., they're fabulous in Northside. They provide free art activities for kids. And then we feed them dinner for the families and the children
that
each week.
That is so wonderful. On the cookies, did you always grow up wanting to bake?
It's interesting. People either fall into two, maybe three camps, not bakers or chefs at all, or the chefs or bakers. And I always was a baker. I actually started baking, I think, in like so many little kids with an Easy Bake Oven.
I was going to say, I even burnt my Easy Bake Oven cakes.
Oh, that's pretty hard. Yeah. But I actually, it was very funny. I won 2 years in a row for pound cake, and I don't remember what the second was, the state fair when I was in fourth grade.
So are these your own recipes?
A lot of them are. We've come up, we have a pretty diverse line. We're a boutique bakery, which means that you're going to find something a little bit different than you would if you went to a more traditional bakery. We have a complete line of little bite-sized cookies, and those are my recipes, and those are four very distinct, wonderful little bites of joy. There's a really rich, buttery shortbread, a chocolate chipotle, which has a kick of fire at the end, an award winner. It was won second place Outstanding Cookie of the Year last year by the Fancy Food Show, which is like getting nominated for an Oscar in the food industry. Rosemary Sesame, which is more savory, goes great with wine and cheese, and then Blueberry Maple. And then, of course, we have Schnecken, which is off the charts and has won multiple awards and been in Oprah this last month.
So you started your basement just a couple of years ago, and now you've recently expanded to four buildings?
Four buildings, yeah, it's crazy. Well, we went from the basement, which was teeny, teeny tiny, a commercial kitchen, but it was still pretty tiny, to the carriage house on my property. And so we had been looking for about a year to buy a property. I was very committed to staying in Northside, and so we bought an old church complex.
And if people would like more information about Queen City Cookies or where they can buy them, what's the contact information?
Well, queencitycookies.com is our website, and our phone number is 513-591-0022.
Can you buy them in the stores?
All over.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Peggy Shannon. Peggy is the founder of Queen City Cookies, and I love this business because it's truly a business that it's a purpose-driven business. You do this in large part because you want to support various charities and nonprofits.
Yes, and that's really the reason that we started the company and what gets me out of bed in the morning. It's really exciting. I just actually came up with a new idea last week that we could partner with different nonprofits and co-brand the cookies and charge a little bit more money for them, but then all of that money goes directly to that charity.
That is amazing.
I think one of the things that's sad to me is that people feel discouraged that because of their financial situation that they might not be able to contribute to society in a way that they'd like to. But even if you just sit down and read to kids at a school, or there's lots of tutoring opportunities, wordplay. I don't know if you know wordplay.
Sure, I do.
In Northside, they have a tutoring program for kids at risk. and they're always looking for tutors and treat their tutors quite well. So it's a great way to give back.
You know, even when we started our nonprofit called Accounting for Kids, I think to the extent that the adults can just be with the children for a little while and see what a little bit of time with the child can really do. And what you're doing is just remarkable. And what you are doing is you're making these amazing cookies. It's been featured on show like Oprah. You've been in the Wall Street Journal. You've been on Real Simple.
Yeah, that not the cookies so much, the Schnecken. Yeah, the Schnecken is, we like to refer to it lovingly, of course, as crack in a box. And I always joke that people need to maybe check into a 12-step group. It's really that good.
And you've come up with something called Bacon Schnecken.
Bacon Schnecken actually was nominated by the Fancy Food Show for Outstanding New Product of the Year last year, and which
it's
is kind of like winning the Oscar or being nominated for an Oscar.
And what's this amazing cookie that you had called Rosemary Sesame Shortbread?
Sounds
decadent.
Decadent. It's more designed for wine and cheese,
okay,
and having friends over and having something that you want a little bit of sweetness, but not too much.
So you started your business about 2 years ago in your basement. You've obviously grown, but you started during a time when many people were afraid to certainly go out and take a risk and start a new business. How did that happen?
Well, you know, in 2008 and 2009, you may remember back then the city was having budget problems and the ongoing conversation about where the swimming pool is going to close. I wanted to do something to make sure we didn't continue to have those conversations.
But you came out right when the rest of the economy or people were concerned about the economy.
I think when I'm motivated to move, I move.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I don't really think
about it. What
tips
would you have for then someone who's listening today who maybe has this in inner desire to do something, help someone start a business? What tips do you have?
I think three things. There's never the perfect time. And if you want to do it, do it. There's never going to be, you know, a lot of people will say, well, when I retire or when I get enough money or when I fill in the blank. That's just an excuse to keep you from moving forward. So if you really are committed to doing it, I would do it. But I think also one thing that's really important, and I am so sad to see so many people fail with small business, is you need to have enough money. And they need more money than they ever think they'll need.
If people want to buy your cookies or find out more about Queen City Cookies, where can they get that information?
QueenCityCookies.com. Our phone number, of course, is 513-591-0022.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, one of our recent articles in the Cincinnati Inquirer discussed the alternative minimum tax, which is a dreaded word for many people, and it's just very complicated. But, you know, this was actually a concept, a tax that was conceived back in 1969 to ensure that the wealthiest taxpayers paid at least some amount of income tax. And it only affected just a handful of people back then, but now millions of people are impacted.
Yeah, there were actually less than 100 people, and there was a report that came out that said they had paid zero income tax. So they enacted this alternative minimum tax, which has now evolved to the point where almost 30 million taxpayers are affected by it. And even though the name alternative would imply that you might have some option in the matter, it's not. The alternative is you pay the highest tax.
That's
whether
right.
It's that one or the regular tax.
Yes, you calculate your tax using both the regular tax system and the tax rates, and then again under the alternative minimum tax system, and you pay whichever is higher. Seems like a ludicrous thing when you think about the fact that this was intended just to capture tax for about 100 people.
Well, the good news about the alternative tax, if you're in it, is that the highest rate is 28%. You pay it either a 26% or 28% tax rate. So it's a lesser rate than the highest marginal tax rate, which was 35% last year.
Well, everything is relative. You say it's a lesser tax rate, but the problem is that it denies you many deductions that you'd otherwise be entitled to under the regular tax system, such as state and local income taxes and property taxes. And here in Kentucky and Ohio, both of those are fairly high tax states. A lot of people who live in these two states get penalized.
Right, because not only do you have the state taxes, but the property taxes and lots of local income taxes, which aren't as common in other parts of the country. Another thing that can cause you to have alternative minimum tax is having too many kids.
Right, exactly.
Because they don't allow you the exemptions for alternative minimum tax.
You do not get to take the exemptions for your children when you're in the AMT. And, you know, having a business can also cause you to pay alternative minimum tax if your business income is passed through onto your regular income tax return.
Yes, in many cases, primarily because of depreciation differences between regular tax and alternative tax, the business will cause you to have alternative minimum tax. I guess the good news is, if you have a business, any deductions in the business help lower your alternative yes. minimum tax. About the only thing that you can do to lower alternative minimum tax is to lower your adjusted gross income, which usually means either business deductions or just postponing income or having deductions for things like qualified retirement plans.
There was a permanent fix to the alternative minimum tax in the most recent change in the tax laws, which basically allows for the quote-unquote AMT patch to become permanent. Every year, we had to wait to see if Congress was going to enact the patch, effectively increase the exemption to reduce the number of people that would be subject to AMT, and they did make that permanent. One thing I do want to mention is that if you are in the alternative minimum tax in a particular year and you may not be in the AMT in a different year, it's a great opportunity to plan because you mentioned earlier the marginal tax rate is less under AMT. So if you are going to be in the alternative minimum tax in a certain year, you may want to think about accelerating income so that you can pay tax on that income at a lower rate if you're not going to be subject to AMT in a prior or future year.
Right, and bunch your deductions for things like taxes so they go in the year of regular tax.
Yes, there's quite a bit of planning to do when you're in the AMT, and you can save a lot of money if you just take the time to do the planning. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Crystal, you know a topic that seems to come up more often lately is whether or not an individual that works for a business is an employee or an independent contractor. And the reason I think that's become more important is with healthcare reform and certain size businesses required to have healthcare coverage for all their employees or face a penalty, I think they're looking for ways to have less employees, and one is to characterize them as independent contractors. But it's not as simple as that, is it?
No, it's not as simple. And just having an agreement between a company and the, quote, independent contractor, basically stating that that individual is working in the capacity as an independent contractor instead of an employee, that's not good enough. Clearly, if the employer-employee relationship exists, if you are doing all the things or many of the things that most employers do when they have employees in terms of managing the employee, telling the employee when to come and go, providing the tools and the resources for the employee, then you know what? It's an employee.
That's true. But there are reasons that people are independent contractors and not employees. For instance, if they offer their services to multiple companies, that may be an indicator. And if they work out of their home or their own office versus the employers, that may be an indicator. There's actually about 20 factors that are looked at to determine whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor, and not any one factor governs. But it's the preponderance of the factors that weigh in your favor, whether you are an employee or an independent contractor.
And that's why this is such a hot area in terms of IRS scrutiny, because it's not black and white. It's not an objective test per se. There is some level of subjectivity that goes into it. One big factor is who bears the risk of profit or loss. So in essence, if you hire someone to perform a particular task, can that person make a profit? Can that person experience a loss? If the person's just going to get paid by the hour, regardless of the outcome, probably an employee.
Right. But you could be a commissioned salesperson. You still have that profit or loss factor, and you may still be an employee, depending on whether you're controlled by the employer or not. So there's a lot of factors involved. I think the IRS is probably going to look at this even closer in the future because of the healthcare aspect of this. If you do have a relationship with someone that you want to characterize as an independent contractor, I think it's very important that you document all the factors that go in your favor. While the contract won't control whether or not it's treated that way, you certainly want to have a contract and discuss it with your attorney and make sure that it indicates the relationship correctly.
And certainly another issue would be in terms of how you pay your worker, whether you pay them every week, every month, just like you do regular employees. Is it subject to a contract? Can the contract be terminated at any time?
Yeah. Do they submit an invoice? That's a good indicator.
Who sets the hours? who bears the costs and the expenses of actually performing the service and any materials and supplies. As you mentioned, there are 20 factors. You can go to the IRS website at www.irs.gov and look for those 20 factors.
Or you can even submit a form and they'll give you an opinion as to whether your relationship qualifies as an employee or independent contractor one.
Just know that it can be tricky and the penalties are stiff and severe. So make sure that you have your ducks in a row so that you can avoid any tax impact that could potentially harm you and your business. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Aisha Armstrong. Aisha is the president and owner of MomCorps here in Cincinnati. Explain what MomCorps really does.
So we're a national staffing company, and we work with employers to help them find professionals who are looking for flexible work arrangements. So most of our candidates do tend to be moms, hence the name MomCorps, who are either going back to work and are looking for something flexible or are working full-time and trying to find something more family-friendly than what they have.
So your typical job is for somebody who's going to work less than a 40-hour week?
Well, it depends. I mean, flexibility means different things to different people. So some people are happy to work 40-plus hours a week if maybe they can flex time or work from home one day a week. Although most of the positions that we do recruit for are around 20 to 30 hours a week.
Have you seen an uptick in the number of people looking to work, even flexible hours, because of the economy?
Yeah, I've definitely seen an increase. I don't know if it's so much the economy as it is the advancement in technology. So people understand that it is easier to work a more flexible schedule and value that and want to take advantage of it.
Well, how has your business been? Has it been growing?
Yeah, so 2012 was a great year for us. We grew revenues at about 80%. So that was...
That's significant growth.
It was, yes. It was quite a challenge, but we got through it, grew the team, and are really looking forward to 2013.
So what do you see as your opportunities and challenges this year as well as in the next couple of years?
Yeah, so I think there's still continued uncertainty around the economy. Definitely saw a slowdown in hiring right before the election, although that did pick up after the election. But I think there's still some conservatism around hiring. Another challenge, just a personal challenge for our business, continues to be how do we best grow our market? So we're really well established among employers kind of in the 20 to 200 employee range, but would love to start working with larger employers and are trying to figure out the best way to do that.
So this is a franchise, correct? You purchased this franchise. What advice do you have? And maybe you can share how you came about choosing this particular franchise.
Yeah, so I opened MomCorps in 2009, and I didn't have a background in the staffing industry, but I saw a real opportunity to help employers who were looking for professionals who aren't using your traditional means to find an opportunity. And those were professionals like myself. So I had two young kids, an MBA, and I was tired of working 60-plus hours a week and traveling at the drop of a hat. So I knew that there was a market out there. So I purchased the MomCorps franchise, and it was great for me because I didn't have a background in the staffing industry, so I definitely needed that support and that training. And it was also an opportunity to get in with a company that was relatively young and growing. So I was the fourth franchise owner for MomCorps.
How many of them are there?
There are 17 now. So we're nationwide in most of the major metropolitan areas.
So who would you like to appeal to today? So someone listening, I know you mentioned you'd like to get in front of some bigger employers.
Right. So I'm always interested in speaking with employers who are looking for new ways to find great talent, but also very interested to hear from candidates who are looking for opportunities and might be interested in using MomCorps to help them find their next job.
If someone would like to reach you, what is your contact information?
Yeah, so the best way is to go on our website, and it's www.momcorps, and that's MomCorps with an S on the end of it, .com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Aisha Armstrong. Aisha is the owner and president of MomCorps Cincinnati. And Aisha, MomCorps recruits, as the name implies, oftentimes moms, but generally people who want to work a more flexible schedule, whether that's reduced hours or just flexible hours. And you try to match them with employers that are willing to do that. And I noticed recently that Yahoo is bringing its people back from home. What's your read on that?
Well, I think there are two ways to look at it. I mean, the first way is for most employers, letting employees who are strong performers work from home is actually a good idea. So the research shows that people who want to work virtually tend to be more productive when they do that than when they're in the office. Now, obviously, not all positions can be virtual, but many, many can, especially with the advancements that we see in technology. So generally, I think allowing people to work from home, whether it's one day a week, up to even 5 days a week, is a great idea for most employers. Now, Yahoo, I think, is a kind of a different egg. They're obviously in a turnaround situation. The CEO is trying to bring the company back and hopefully put it on the same playing field as like a Google and a Facebook. And those type of companies, they're the types of employees that they attract are not employees who are looking for flexibility. Those people are looking to make a lot of money, and they're willing to work 120 hours a week in the office, not see their family in order to get that kind of payoff. So I think for her and her business, I understand why she made that decision, but I don't think it should be a signal to most employers that this is a way to make your company more productive.
So you don't think that this is any kind of trend in terms of workforce and how employers are going to shift the way they've been thinking historically?
No, I mean, honestly, from my vantage point, I see more and more employers be open to letting people work from home. But again, I think you have to look at the specifics and the culture of work in Silicon Valley. And those people want money, not flexibility.
How much do you think communication suffers, or does it suffer at all, if a lot of your people are working from home versus in wherever the corporate office is?
Yeah, I think it can if you don't have the right practices in place. So it's a great idea to have things like Instant Messenger to make sure that everyone has their phone available and answers it at all work hours during the day, that people have cell phones, that they know what people's cell phones numbers are. If you don't put the right practices in place, communication can definitely suffer. But again, we've got the technology now. It shouldn't be a big issue.
Aisha, let me just shift gears for a moment. How do you feel the labor market's doing, and what trends are you seeing in hiring?
Yeah, so things are definitely picking up. I mean, I would say our searches, even though we have a lot of great candidates, is definitely taking us longer, that it's more competitive out there than it was before. Now, that's a good thing for my business because it means that employers need help and that they're willing to be creative and think differently about how they're going to attract and retain the best talent.
Well, on the job seeker side, what advice do you have for them?
So the first one would be create a target list. So you would not believe how many job seekers I sit down with and I say, well, who's on your target list? And I get a blank stare. So it's a really good idea to do your research and know what companies would be a great fit for your skills and your personality. The second one is to network. I mean, most jobs are found through networking, whether it's virtual networking or in person. That's so, so important. And then the third one is to follow up. Even if you're following up 3 or 4 times, don't just assume because you sent one email that the person you want to see your resume saw it. It's okay to follow up multiple times, phone calls and email.
And if folks listening would like your contact information, what is it?
It's best to go to our website, which is www.momcore.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Jennifer Wolf. Jennifer is an attorney, but she's much more than an attorney. She is a proven entrepreneur. She's very involved in digital brand strategy, innovation, intellectual property. She has been named as one of the top 300 global intellectual property strategists in the entire world. So we're really thrilled and delighted to have Jen with us as our guest. And Jennifer, I love going to the computer and just amazingly and magically, the internet can pop up when I click on a button, but there's a lot more to it than that. And you actually sit on a council that, quote, runs the internet.
That's right, Crystal. I sit on the Generic Name Supporting Organization Council of ICANN, which is the nonprofit organization chartered by the U.S. government to run the internet. And on that council, we set public policy for the use of the internet around the globe.
Well, and there's some interesting things coming that I think a lot of people don't know concerning how you name yourself on the internet. Like the .com is going to go away at some point, isn't it?
That's right. What's happening right now is ICANN has launched a new top-level domain program. So what that means is in the 3-month period of last year, they allowed companies, brands, or entrepreneurial companies to apply for their own top-level domain. So what that means is instead of going to a .com, you might go to a .inc or a .llc or a .accountants or .lawyers, .tennis, .golf, all just to name a few. This is happening because essentially it was determined that the .com environment was fairly saturated. It was very difficult to find new names and one opportunity to create new opportunities for the entrepreneurial community, for brands to use more robust capabilities within their .com environment was to allow them to expand into the top level domain. So for example, most of the world's top banks have applied for their own top level domain. That means you'll see .JP Morgan, .Amex, .Visa, .Citigroup, etc.
And this is not a cheap endeavor, is it?
No, not at all. The application fee alone was $185,000. And the reason it was set at such a high price was essentially to stop cyber squatters, people who just want to sit on something and then charge it to someone else at a later point of time at a higher level. So ICANN set some very high standards, not just in the application fee, but in the application itself, to provide a business model that showed you really understood what it would take to operate essentially a backbone of the internet.
So what strategy should a company have knowing that this is coming? Should they be thinking about which domain they want to go under?
Absolutely. Every company out there needs to be thinking about where do I want my domain to reside when the entire internet explodes and changes in this environment. So for example, for your firm, you would want to know who's going to operate .cpa, who's going to operate .accountants or .finance or anything related to the financial industry. There's probably at least 15 to 20 top level domains related to your industry. So you'll want to look at those, look at who's operating them, and determine where do I want to be. One of the most important reasons for this is that everything you know about search is going to change. Because we've interviewed top search engine optimization experts, we've interviewed people at Yahoo, Bing, Google, all of the search engines, and what we know is that that top level will become much more weighted than .com.
So again, someone listening today, they know this is going to be happening. And in what's the time frame?
The first top level domains will likely start to launch in the fourth quarter of this year. The big movement will be when all of the big brands start to launch, and that will be into 2014. And that's when we'll see a big shift in consumer behavior. Google applied for approximately 100 top level domains, Amazon for 76, Microsoft for 11. Half of the world's top brands have all applied for their own top level domain. That movement will start to change consumer behavior.
And Jen, if people want to learn more about this, you help businesses understand this better and position themselves, correct?
That's right. We have a consulting firm that actually works with businesses to help understand the changing environment, understand where they want to be, understand when it impacts them and when they need to make strategic steps to protect their brand as the internet changes.
And what is your contact information?
Our company name is Wolf Domain, and that is wolfdomain.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Jennifer Wolf. Jennifer is an attorney. She's also an author of the book Domain Names Rewired. She has a company called Wolf Domain. She's an expert on intellectual property and the internet in general. She sit on the committee for the Governing Council of the Internet. And Jen, you wrote this book. Most people probably don't even know, or at least Crystal and I didn't know, that domain names are about to change rather dramatically. Maybe you can just highlight what's coming.
Sure. So what's happening is ICANN, the organization that runs the internet, has allowed for companies to apply for their own top-level domain. So for example, within the next year, we will see companies like JP Morgan owning a .JP Morgan or Macy's owning .Macy's. We'll see this shift start to occur beginning in probably early 2014. And it impacts every business because what will happen as consumers shift behavior away from .com and into this .brand or top-level domain environment is that .com will essentially become diluted.
So what should you do if you're a business owner? Maybe you're not a Macy's or a JP Morgan. You are Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens or another privately held business.
So every business owner needs to first understand what's going to happen because every business operates in some way or another on the internet. You likely have a .com. You likely look at analytics in some way, you likely use some sort of search optimization, all of those things are going to change. So you need to at least have a framework understanding of what's happening. And then second to that, you need to look at your strategy and understand, if I am Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, do I want to stay in .com or do I want to ensure that I get Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens or CFS in the .CPA extension or the .accountants or the .finance, because all of those will be available. And if you don't apply for them and someone else does, then you've lost out on that important internet real estate.
And your new book is called?
Domain Names Rewired.
If someone wanted to pick the book up, what would be a takeaway?
The key takeaway, and what we tried to do in writing the book, is really interview top companies like Microsoft, like Yahoo, like Procter & Gamble, and really understand what is the implication to consumers and to businesses as the internet shifts. And so based upon that research and looking at other paradigm shifts, we've laid out predictions so that the key takeaway is businesses can understand we're about to undergo a paradigm shift in the internet. And every single company that has a .com needs to understand the basic tenets of what's about to change.
And if folks want to pick up the book, where can they find it?
Sure, they can find it on Amazon.com, of course, and Barnes & Noble.
And Jen, you help organizations muddle through this, because to you, it just flows off the tip of your tongue. To someone like me, you know, I didn't even know there was an organization that ran the internet, much less the fact that these domain issues were on the horizon. So you help them strategically look at all of that type of information.
That's right. That's right. And this is very complex and it's very new. It hasn't been widely covered in the media, primarily because it's still a program in development. It hasn't launched yet. And so typically that doesn't start to get covered until it launches. But every business really needs to educate themselves and understand how the internet will change. This is really like having a heads up. If you were thinking about your business back in the late 80s and someone said, hey, this internet's about to start and it's about to change everything, you might have planned a little bit differently for your business. Or likewise, social media, you know, really took hold around 2004, 2005. If someone could have told you in 2002 what was going to happen, you might have approached how you responded to Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter a little bit differently.
And not just about responding. In my mind, it's really about proactive execution of whatever is going to make your business the best shape. And certainly organizations like you, Jen, and people who do think that way are great advisors to surround yourself with. If folks would like to get in touch with you, what is your contact information?
Sure. Our contact information is Wolf Domain, and we can be found at wolfdomain.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is David Main. David is the president and CEO of the Hamilton County Development Company. And David, a lot of people know about Hamilton County Development Company, particularly with regard to the incubator that you have in Norwood. But you have other facets of the organization that are just as important. You help a lot of companies get loans. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that part of your program.
HCDC administers the SBA, or Small Business Administration 504 loan program, through its certified development company. This program provides long-term, 10 or 20 years, financing at a fixed interest rate. Currently, the 20-year term is 4.12% and enables businesses to acquire fixed assets, primarily real estate, on occasion machinery and equipment. Over the years, HCDC has approved over $361 million worth of loans and has financed nearly $1 billion worth of projects. Now, we make these loans not only in Hamilton County, but throughout the state of Ohio and the Commonwealth of Kentucky. But being a certified development company has also helped establish a culture at HCDC. And what I mean by that is we had to actually go out and market and find prospects, qualify them not only for credit underwriting, but also eligibility for SBA financing, then process them through our own approval process, submit them, package them to the SBA. Once they're approved, close and fund, and lately, particularly with the recession, service these loans.
Who would be the primary candidates for your loans?
We're looking for businesses that need to expand, they need to acquire real estate, need to buy a bigger building, maybe they even need to buy the facility they're leasing. Companies that are looking to expand, they have to have a net worth of less than $15 million, profits after taxes of under $8 million. If they exceed those, there's another way to qualify them under the regular SBA program.
So this is really for small businesses?
Correct. Small for-profit businesses. Almost any type of for-profit business will qualify. There are a few notable exceptions. We cannot do nonprofits, and there are a few others that are ineligible.
And David, I think a lot of people over the years have equated small business loans, SBA loans, with those that have more strings attached. Is that true?
There are probably a few more strings from the standpoint that it's not enough for a business merely to be eligible on CreditWise. They need to show an extrinsic benefit. What I mean by that is they need to demonstrate that they are going to either retain or, more importantly, create new jobs. One job for $65,000 of SBA loan money, which is 40% of a project, or up to 40% of a project, or in the case of manufacture, up $100,000. They can also qualify as under what's considered a national objective. It can be an exporter, it can be a minority business, or it can be a facilitating community benefit. For example, locating in an enterprise zone or diversifying a local economy. We've been involved with doing some small restaurants in neighborhood business districts that were part of the revitalization strategy.
Mm-hmm. And so for people who don't understand, you mentioned 40%, and that's because effectively they're still borrowing their money from a bank. It's just the SBA, the Small Business Administration, is guaranteeing 40%.
That's correct. The structures, they really have two loans. They have a 50% first mortgage from a bank, private lender, normally it's a bank. They have 40% from HCDC. We take a second mortgage, and then they're required to put up 10%. In some cases, if it's a startup business, they need to put an additional 5% down, or if it's a single-purpose building, they may have to put another 5% down. But the typical structure is 50-40-10.
And if folks listening today would like to get more information about those loans or about Hamilton County Development Company, your website is?
HCDC.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is David Main, the president, CEO, and founder of the Hamilton County Development Company. And also, David, you founded the Hamilton County Business Center back in 1989, which is an incubator for startups. And it does seem like we have so much focus here in our region on startups. And those are great. But what about those established businesses that's been here for 5 years, 10 years, 100 years? These businesses who know how to stay in business. They've got staying power, but they might need just a little shot in the arm to get them to the next level, and they also could create jobs. Why don't we pay any attention or give those companies as much love as we do the startups?
I think the startups get a lot of the attention love because it's part of the American dream where you can start with nothing and create something. However, startups as a rule have a horrendous track record, and there's a very minute number that create most of the jobs. However, if you look at companies that have been around a number of years, they perhaps have revenues of over $1 million, but under $50 million. What we're finding is that may be where the jobs are. And it's one of the things we've tried to do with the third ring of Hamilton County Development Company, our economic development office, is work on the retention and expansion of those existing businesses and industries. In fact, as a rule, 80% of the net new jobs come from the expansion of these companies. There are a number of them that are small manufacturers, tool and die shops, and they are the backbone. And that is one of the things that has kept this region vibrant. They provide good opportunities. Someone does not need an advanced degree as long as they have a good work ethic. And there's a number of those companies. In fact, that's one of the other areas we focused on in addition to the startups.
And with those companies, what areas do they need help?
Most all of them need help in financing, and a lot of it is just their reluctance to approach somebody, or what do they need to do to go get a bank loan, and how do they prepare for that? The other things may include strategic planning when you get to a certain standpoint. Where should you take this business? Just because things have worked in the past doesn't mean it's going to work in the future. And then as you grow a business, as you add employees, probably there's a number of things dealing with human resource issues.
Well, and I also always question, you've got this great business. They've been doing the same thing for many, many years in terms of the product or service they're providing. But what if you would combine that traditional way of thinking with maybe someone who has some innovative ideas, someone who can come in, take a fresh look at their business, say, how about if you did this, you know, apply technology in this way, you could actually make your business go to a different level?
Well, from our experience, that's what we're seeing, particularly some of our loan clients, where they've had the next generation come in. We've had a number of borrowers that have indicated to me that they've had children, maybe two of the three weren't interested in it, and the one they thought the last thing they want to do is go in the business. They come in, they're technologically savvy, and they've made a difference. And as long as the existing management is willing to at least consider these ideas, that's where it can make a difference. Oftentimes, it's a matter of blowing up things where they used to be and trying something different.
So do you see going forward for 2013 and beyond, I mean, do you see that niche that you just mentioned, do you see some additional growth there?
I think there are opportunities dealing with existing business and industry that, and that particularly their retention expansion, that have historically been overlooked because it's not sexy. They're not going to get headlines. There's not going to be a big announcement that, oh, XYZ company that has 10 employees is going to 12 is going to get a front page. But that's a 20% increase in employment. And if you have a number of these, they add up. And plus, it diversifies your economy. So you've got it spread out among a number of businesses. I would much rather have 10 businesses, each employing 50, than one business employing 500.
And if folks would like to learn more about Hamilton County Development Company or the Hamilton County Business Center, what's your website?
Our website is hcdc.com.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate.